Thank you so much, Latham. I saw a lot of familiar faces actually when Latham was introducing me. I saw all these people and I realized I shouldn't encourage Neil to ask too many questions because that would be too many. No, I'm kidding. It's okay. It's great to see so many familiar faces. I saw Alex is here, Dustin. Anyway, there's just a lot of people. So glad to see all these familiar faces. I would love to visit someday in person. So hopefully that will happen soon without too much trouble. I'll talk about learning symbolic equations with deep learning today. It is heresy by some area of expertise. Some other people think it's really exciting. There's a lot of zeros and ones right now. So either you're really interested in it and think it's really cool, or you think it's complete heresy because that's what scientists usually do, right? Learning symbolic equations, coming up with it. So let's see what happened today. And this is the work a lot done with my students and other collaborators. So Miles Kramer from Princeton, who's a fourth year grad student, Ru Su, who was at Princeton, who just graduated, Pavel Lemos, who's now at postdoc, and will be coming to actually Montreal and CCA with a joint postdoc between Miller, not Miller Fellow, but Montreal Institute for Machine Learning, basically, and CCA soon. Now Jeffrey at ENS, Kimberly Stachenfeld, who's a research scientist at DeepMind, Peter Battaglia is a senior research scientist at DeepMind, so is Alvaro Sanchez, Kyle Kramer at NYU, who I think is moving to Wisconsin soon, and there is Spurgo, who just recently became the Simons Foundation president, but he has a foot in, you know, of course, Flatiron Institute very closely. So what do we talk about today? It's not so cosmology. We'll have a little bit of cosmology later on, but we'll start with sort of linguist perspective. It's kind of funny. How do you understand a scene? So this is very familiar for any parents or anyone who has a house with lots of stuff during the pandemic, because if you start parsing into physical objects in relation, you kind of expect what's going to happen, right? You start reasoning about objects and their interactions, how they support the ground supporting, you know, the guitar and the shelf, and the box might not be attached to the shelf and it might fall or not. And you describe it with sort of like a word, precarious. And it happened so much to my house, at least during the pandemic. And this is just to illustrate how humans have an intuitive physics engine in the head. It's not just physicists, like anybody, you know, everyone does that. You know, see a bunch of stuff, you basically try to reason with yourself whether what will happen as t goes to zero to t equals to n, and in which direction it will fall and will it fall. This is a paper led by Peter Battaglia, one of my collaborators that I mentioned earlier, who did it with as a postdoc, actually. And here, I will show a bunch of different experiments with this idea that they had that developed something called graph neural network. And particularly, it's called interaction network, where they describe a system with a bunch of nodes, like graph, and edges where you connect the nodes. And once you do that, you can make the machine to look at a bunch of simulations and make predictions of what will happen. And there are different predictions, whether it will fall, and it will try to see whether the machine makes a better prediction or the human. So they actually ask the humans to also look at a bunch of situations and decide what the, you know, whether it will fall or not, and see, you know, how well they correlate between the machine and the humans, and then which direction it will fall. And you can also do it with different masses and see whether the predictions works well. And there could be much more complex scenes where you have a force acting from an angle, you have red blocks and yellow blocks, and you ask yourselves how many blocks are gonna fall and what color are they gonna fall. So much more complex derivations. Also here, this one, they infer the masses of, you know, sort of unknown block masses. So trying to figure out, say, you know, whether the purple blocks is a certain kilogram, and let machine basically have to figure out, and the humans sort of compare the performance. Also, same thing with the fluids. They try to predict how much fluid on both sides, or which one has more water for both machine and the humans. And surprisingly, with this graph neural network, they actually do extremely well modeling these predictions, and sometimes actually outperform the humans. And this goes back a little bit to more physics perspective, where if you see a bunch of, you know, particles moving around, in this case it could be planets going around the sun, you go in t equals zero, you see this next one step, and you also look at the next time step again and say, okay, so I have observation at T0 and T1, can I predict what happens? So by observing these systems, usually we try to figure out what happened next, and this is what scientists do. Doesn't have to be planetary system, but say this is a very famous example. I'm gonna pull out the Isaac Newton apple tree, supposedly in his manner. I don't know, they claim it's the same tree according to Wikipedia. So either that, you know, we somehow figure out a way to get to these laws, moving, you know, looking at planets moving around, can we figure out the laws governing the motion of the planets? We can either work super hard or lucky or whatever that came up with it, just like Newton did. And or I'll be supposedly giving some kind of crazy ideas that we should do symbolic regression. It is a branch of a genetic programming or evolutionary programming. If you look at, you know, the history, it's not something we invented. It's been around for a while. It is a way to search a tree of equations, basically. I'll explain what it is a little bit here. So what is symbolic regression? We have a bunch of mathematical functions and variables. We can form new equations in each node. There could be a mathematical functions or variable. It can form a tree. And you can check whether these new equations fit the observables. Every time you form a new tree, you check whether the predictions that it makes fit the observables that you actually are comparing against. And if it does, great. Then you say, okay, this is a great equation. If it doesn't, then you move on to the next equation and find better fit. When I say it does and it doesn't, there are certain ways to sort of decide how to decide which equation is a better fit. This is still somewhat, actually it's very much in progress in the sense that how do you decide equation, you know, a much more complex equation will fit better because there's more parameter, you can fit the variable better versus you want a cleaner equation because a lot of scientists might think we naturally prefer, you know, much simpler equation. They use the word, this rule called Occam razor rule. You can go into that a lot, but basically the idea is that you have a large search space to search the right equation. And it's really hard usually. The issue is it's a super large search space and you can't just, you know, exponentially look at all the equations. So what do we do? Here, what we did is that we combine neural network, which in this particular case, we use graphical neural network to predict the dynamics first. So this graph network somehow found a low dimensional representation of what the system is doing, trying to distill it into a much simpler modular form. And once you get there, you can interpret the network and hopefully you'll get a fitting formula maybe, or maybe a more fundamental law. So I don't claim I always get fundamental laws, but maybe at least a fitting formula that explains why the network makes good predictions. So that's what we're gonna do. I can pause a little bit and see if there are questions. People have questions. I don't see hand raising right now. So, it's way too clear. Neil doesn't have a question. All right. So now we do this in two steps. We have this simple particle going around this data set. We use graphical neural network, which is, there are many other networks, but this is the one we decide to use because it's so close to a lot of systems that we actually are working with. And then we predict dynamics with the system. When you're doing the prediction of dynamics, you want to encourage low dimensionality representation. What I mean by that is sort of similar to what I said earlier. You want to be as simple as possible in terms of what symbolic regression need to interpret, basically. And then hopefully you'll get some kind of equation. So we try a bunch of different systems, but the first part we need to do is that for whatever system, you need to make sure the network can make really good prediction first. So the usual things, you make predictions, you compare, you update these weights within the network to make sure the output is good. So that's the first thing we do. But before we go in, I want to give a tiny bit of details of the graph network that we're using called interaction network. I think it's actually a cool tool that a lot of people get really excited about these days. A graph is a natural way to represent entities and their relations. We can look at the nodes V1, V2, V3, the edges H1, you know, E2, and at nodes here could be anything really, just entities, objects can be events, edges correspond to the relationships, the interactions can be transitions. We can infer about the entities and the relations with respect to this graphic structure. So the assumption you have here is that there is a graph structure you need to sort of respect. You can capture many things like the molecules, mass spring system where the spring could be formed by many, many different nodes. But then you can notice that there is a unidirectional edge versus bidirectional edges. If you think that the mass here is not going to move at all, you can just enforce that it can only act on the node, but the node doesn't act on it. For example, the N-bar system is a fully connected graph. That's pretty easy to imagine. There are balls bouncing on four walls, then the wall here can be something that's rigid, so it actually doesn't get acted upon by these other nodes. So there is some prior information you put in, prior knowledge you put in when you construct this graph. Sentence and parse tree, you can actually connect the whole sentence with like a node. Image and fully connected scene graph, you can also split it up for an image into many different nodes. I wouldn't recommend this necessarily for graphs, neural network to deal with images, but people do that. And how do we actually do this? Like a little bit of nitty gritty detail. I do see a hand raised. I can take the questions now if you want. Yes, Charlie.
Yeah, yes, I'm Anna, but kind of Charlie's. I was just wondering, because you mentioned low dimensionality and at the same time graphs, does this mean you're restricting yourself to edges that only go between two nodes, or do you also consider hypergraphs?
So this is a great question. So we don't do very complex graph in the stuff that we have right now. It's really just like edges between the two nodes. But in principle, you can have multiple message passing. So you could get multiple node interactions. So it doesn't have to be only two node interactions. This is something completely still in development. We're recently looking into something that requires a hierarchical graph structure and where we expect only certain nodes interact with each other, and even within the node, there's certain things that might interact within, like inside the node attributes. I can go into this in way more details, but it is very much a very new field. So many things haven't been done yet. Okay. That's a great question. This graph. We have the N-bar system. So this is a very simple system. I picked this partially because the astrophysicists and physicists I talked to very much visualize it quickly. We have these edges, and you can even have a self edge, right? Connects it back to yourself. There's a global property. It could be like total angular momentum, total energy, Hamiltonian, Lagrangian, all that stuff, if you like. For an edge function, a compute messages from nodes and edge attributes. So for each node, there's some attributes. In this case, you could imagine could be masses. It could be positions and velocities. So depending on what information you have about the system, really. And you also probably want to include a global property if you have it, such as could be a conserved number of planets, it could be the total energy or angular momentum, as I mentioned before. And then you have the node function where you update the node info, which is these node attributes we mentioned before, from the previous node state. So, you know, where it was before, how fast it's going, for example, or even the masses. And you use the previous node stage and you aggregate all the messages from all the different other nodes, all the other edges that points to you really in particular, and then you update it. And we don't really tell the network what to do. The network has to basically take all the info from what else observed, and then determine what these edge functions and node functions are. And the network would be trained, change all this weight to make sure in weight in particular in these edge functions and node functions, and to predict the state of, you know, the node at T1 from T0. So that's sort of the fast version of what interaction network is. And I see how it's doing. It connects to many different things, such as deep set, relation network. It is really, you can see it as a framework graph network, because it can be turned into many things, to be honest. So case study, let's dive in a tiny bit more because it has a bit more meat to it this way, where each planet is a node, X, Y, you know, it could be the position and the mass. And for any pair of planets, there is an edge. So it's a fully connected graph. And each edge is a function of the two nodes. So we update each node will depend on all the edges that added upon it, right? Okay, and this is something kind of fun for scientists, I think, to realize how much analogy there is between the graph network and simple Newtonian mechanics in this case. And I go deeper a little bit deeper for those who actually know about machine learning a little bit more. We have the input states, which in this case could be the node and could be the positions and velocities of all the planets and maybe the sun too, right? And then you have other nodes, right? So you have pairs of nodes. So it's like two interacting particles or planets. They have this edge model that you basically need to figure out what it is, right? Because the network doesn't know what the edge is supposed to do. It has to update a bunch of numbers, and hopefully those numbers will create the correct output state later. And you can see that the edge model is probably the force. Here are the messages that you actually encode. And you basically add all the messages together with pool. Pool just means summing, really. You concatenate with the node. In this case, when you do the summing for the concatenation, you're summing all the forces acting upon the node. And you concatenate with the node because you want to have all the previous information of the node, like what it's doing right now, for example, together with the total forces. And then with this factor of numbers, you have another node model, and you supposedly between the node model and the edge model, you need to figure out what to do to update the node so that the output of the next step of these planets would basically fit with what's happening with the observational data or simulated data. I see a raised hand. All right, please, Sebastian.
I have just a question regarding the pooling layer. So do you implement this pooling layer, this linear summation of your messages in the network, or mm-hmm. is that something that the neural network learns by itself? Or if in another way, it's like, do you already implement some properties of forces, or is this learned by the network?
This is a great question. We actually implement a sample. So like we actually forcing it to be linear pooling. We actually had a second paper about this, about if you don't want to pull in this way, what happens and what will be the difference. And for example, in some situations, pooling will force that it has to be a sum over, you know, all the messages from different node. But what if you don't want to sum? What if you want to do a square root of something? Like there's some other things you want to do. In our case, maybe it's a histogram. Right, so we actually had a paper about exactly that, whether if you do it a different way, it's a completely different system that you can model. So you actually can choose what the pooling should be doing. Like, does it have to be linear pooling? Does it sum over a bunch of square roots, square, whatever? But a priori, we, you know, for this particular case and what people had done before, this is like simple pooling. We just did summing. But we have developed other pooling methods since. Great question.
Okay, thanks.
All right, so next step. So outcome, how are we doing, right? Truth on the left and model on the right. So there's a 1,000-step rollout, which basically means we start with the same initial condition. We learn it by one step, and it predicts the next step. And then the next step output will be input for the step after. So you kind of, basically any error will grow dramatically and exponentially. So there's really one step training, which is kind of interesting. We're not trying to train on multiple steps, it's just one step. So how about other more complex situations? It turns out the balls in four walls is really hard because it's very chaotic. The MBOS system and the strings are doing okay. And of course, one can improve this dramatically with more data, and there's a lot of things you can do to make it better. But I think the key point here is that it's doing all right. So now we want to interpret the network. But one more thing you want to check on is whether it is just the network remembering everything and just remembering what the next step should be, given, you know, that approximate situation, and just have like a huge hash table and just remember everything, right? So what we did is that we did something called zero-shot generalization to a larger system, where the network just never seen that many balls before, basically. So the MOS system here has never seen something like this big, and the model seemed to be able to do okay. The balls bouncing falls is really hard regardless. I think even with the more balls, it's even harder. The strain on the mass actually looks pretty okay. So this sort of gave us a little bit of, confidence that the network has learned something more than just memorizing, you know, with a huge hash table, we can have a million weight just go, right? And by the way, our network is very small, so it's actually not so big. It's gonna be hard to memorize. Subhadip has a question.
Hi, Charlie. Hi.
Hi.
Hey. So I'd like to know, like, how you understand that when the network is really learning well, like when you compare with the truth, is there a quantity you compare to say that this is good enough or this is not good enough, does not learn properly? How, what is that parameter you control?
So when I wouldn't say the understanding part yet, but just control whether the network is, you know, predicting well, we usually have this loss function. And in this particular case, you just look at the positions and the velocities, right? Actually, in particular case, it's just the position.
So basically, for a general scenario, you calculate the loss function and whether that's minimized or not.
Mm-hmm. You just minimize loss function, yes. But this is, you know, there are many ways you can change the loss function. For example, if this is for later part of the talk. For example, if you think the solar system should give more weight to Mercury's trajectory, like maybe you should do a different weight, but then you kind of impart prior knowledge quite a bit in this case, right? So you're trying to like push it to fit for GR. Okay, but that's a great question. Any other questions?
No, not now.
Okay. So now that we have a network that can make predictions well, so what happened? We have one challenge left, right? We try to get the symbolic equation on this right-hand side. And what do we really do when I say trying to make this really small, like low representation? So what happened is that you do a lot of these predictions. We have a network that works. You have this message function. Or this edge function that you want to figure out what it's doing and record the messages here. And you can record in a very long string of numbers, but we try to basically force it to have as few numbers as possible. And what we did is that we did a bunch of different things actually. It's nearly trial and error at that point. We given the input simulation was 2D, we first tried and say, okay, for the input simulation as 2D, we probably shouldn't have a force that's much larger than like 2, right? So let's fix it to 2 and see what happened. This only forced it to only have 2 elements. And you find that it actually makes the training a lot longer, the performance not as good immediately. Then we try a bunch of different regularization techniques, but basically just minimizes, try to have different ways to minimize the number of elements that are important to fit the observables to the predictions. Once we try a bunch of different things, L1 is what we settle in for this particular case. We put the edge elements through the symbolic regression and see what we fit for the 2 elements. So this is one of the edge function. It looks kind of funky, but if you use both elements, so if edge elements 1 and 2, then you actually will find it's a rotation of the true force for both of them. So we find force loss recovered from the observed system, in this case, observed simulated systems, for Spring's law and one over R square law in 3D. So this is like a very baby step, like in the beginning what we do and try to figure out whether we can even do this in principle, because no one else were sort of interpreting the network the way we do it before. And we just decide to do something a bit harder, at least something we don't know the answer a priori, because Newton's law is sort of simple. So we had a dark matter simulations. And of course, you know, it's not crazy to think about some questions we should ask about dark matter simulations that we don't know the answer a priori. But I figure if some of the smart people here might figure the answer without us, you know, actually trying to learn it with symbolic regression. So we ask ourselves some simple stuff like, what is the density of dark matter within the center of dark matter halo, given the surrounding halos? Right? So if I only give you the surrounding halos masses or velocities, can you predict the density within the center of the dark matter halo of the central one? We can make guesses what the answer might be, but we don't a priori know what the analytical formula should be. But I figure you guys might figure it out right away, which we don't know at least. So we took the detailed dark matter simulations. We put, you know, the parent halo in the middle, not parent, but the main halo in the middle, and it's all the surrounding halos, right? And we do nearly the same thing. We model a graph network, make good predictions of the central density, and we try to extract an equation, some random unknown dark matter overdensity equation. And we do exactly what we suggested before, except this time we don't really have a good sense of what it should be. So here's what we have. We have these old ones, which basically means things we kind of came up with just because we're forced to. So constant formula, this is the error bar. Simple formula, where M is the mass of the sort of the halo in the middle, and J, MJ here are like the mass of all the surrounding halos. E here is basically put in here, and then it's like pretty decent when you have the simple formula with masses. And the best one that we found with symbolic regression is something like this, which we were still kind of surprised, and we haven't quite figured out why still, but maybe you guys will figure it out quicker than me. So we have decreased error bar quite a lot without actually trying very hard. And then you can also force the network and say, okay, I only have velocities and I don't have masses because I don't see the dark matter halo masses immediately. It's very hard to do. And what if I just get them velocities? And you actually find a different fitting formula right away. So we thought this is kind of cool. We have found some annual analytical formula that is fits quite well. It's like a fitting formula. I'm not claiming it's a physical law at all, but this is something that we can fit well with, you know, better than what we had for physical intuition. So we moved on to something a bit crazier, much more complex situations, because everything we've done so far was quite simple. So we wanted to do something harder that I have to learn something new. So these are 3D uniform compressible decaying turbulence simulated with Athena++. We work with Gemstone on this too. Actually, we just submitted the paper to, I actually just got accepted by ICLAIR 2021. Here is a simulation. The ground truth is here for density, velocity, X, Y, Z, and pressure. And here's a different simulation. But here you have a mixing layer where you have basically very turbulence, a lot of stuff happening in between with different temperature above and below, and very different velocity, just basically two-layer fluid going like this. And so what we did is that we want to fit for this formula. So we have these formula that had generated these simulations, right? And then we say, okay, can we recover the equations that were put in to generate these fairly complex turbulence situations? All right, so here are the target equations. You'll see why I highlighted the red later on. So instead of something like this simple, we're going for like, you know, Navier-Stokes equations, which I'm still learning, to be honest, how this work is much more complex than I'm used to. So we call what we did before. We did all this stuff, you know, we make predictions using graph network, and then you apply some regularization, you try to find the equation with symbolic regression with a search tree. But what turns out is actually really hard to do, you know, a simple L1 regularization. Like we talked about, we try a bunch of different methods to make as small number of elements as possible in that, you know, edge factor. And we actually turn out that we have to change and just, you know, sort of make up a new network called this entangled sparsity network. It's actually really not that hard. It basically, we encourage each output feature to depend on as few input features as possible. So that way we will make the equation finding much easier later on. So these are all very new work. It's still in a workshop, which means, you know, it's not entirely published yet. This is still working on it. So let's see what happens if I force on, you know, this new way of finding latent parameters. Here are these edge factors. There's about 20 of them. Here are all these, like, you know, physical variables that we actually would be quite familiar with. This is like the central density, the central probably like velocity or something like that's here, pressure, density, I forgot what these guys are, it's probably displacements field. And if we roll forward and we make this sparsifying network go, it will actually force very quickly each of the edge elements to depend on as few inputs as possible. So once you get there, then we can interpret it with neural network with symbolic regression. But before that, you know, if you go back, it's sort of all over the place. So each element is depending on like everything. So it's extremely hard to understand which equation we should pull out or can pull out even. It's really hard to search, but in this particular form, right now we're forcing it to only depend on very few things. There is a problem with this method, of course, is that how you initialize the beginning would actually affect things in, you know, which one will tend to have certain dependencies for which edge element, for example. So then we take these edge elements and we fit it into this symbolic regression search tree and find the equation. Let's see what we got. Here's the recovery equations. The red one is the one we didn't recover so well. As I said, it's a work in progress. This is the rho dt, and you can see a true fluid equation. You have rho here, but then somehow it has found pressure. But I guess for that particular situation, we, in retrospect, realized the pressure and rho actually is quite similar. Here, for example, it misses, you know, the rhos here. I would argue that since I recover something like this, our smart scientists might be able to figure out at least some of them, right? So if you see rho Vx, rho Vy, you probably guess rho Vz instead of P. So it got close, but not exact. That's why it was sort of still at the beginning of this very nascent field. Yes, Sebastian, you have a question?
I was just wondering if you tried instead of or just a very basic symbolic regression or polynomial regression, meaning like linear regression with some polynomial features.
We have not tried that. This is actually letting it to have a fairly large search space in you know, possibilities of what you can put in and, you know, what mathematical functions you can put in. So the space is quite large. But if we, in the code, it's public, actually it's completely open source, you can choose to put what you want to try to fit in the code, like in terms of functions.
Yeah. So I just mean all these equations would fit into this pattern, every single one of them. And since it performed, so it's much easier to perform linear regression with polynomial features to recover this than symbolic regression, right?
That is possible, but the symbolic regression, you'll see later on, actually, maybe not today. So we're working on something else right now that requires like switch statements, like logic statements also. So there are things that we want to recover that are not falling to this particular form. But this is a great question. Aman, Argo, do you want to have the next question?
Yes, thank you. When you're sparsifying the network, is there any like loss of, you know, information, or are you doing it in batches so that you can, you know, cover maximum search space?
Not that I know of in terms of loss of information for when you do the sparsification, I think.
Okay.
But, you know, so far, I think there is still, we're not perfect in any ways, right? We can't recover all the equations. As you can see, we recover, this is the central row this is a central row, this one gets the row of the next door neighbor. So there are a few things that is sort of missing. So I'm not claiming this is the correct answer still yet. Still work in progress.
Yeah, I was just wondering, like when we do like leave one out, we sort of do this batches so that going over different batches, you can sort of aggregate stuff. Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
Yeah, so we also haven't trained it super, like with a lot of data also. And one thing we haven't done is also training it with different type of simulated situation, right? Because right now we train it in one specific situation and make it predict well. But then, you know, in principle, you should change all these parameters, you should change the situation. Is it compressible? Is it uncompressible? But like try all these different things and make sure the network seen all those situations before you even try to extract the formula. So we didn't go into like the full blown that way yet. That's going to be like Mao's thesis. So we'll see.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Great question. So how about using some real data? So this is really just the last bit I want to touch on, but this is a great question to ask. Can we use some real data? We've talked about similar data over and over again. You know, sure, we got to a much more complex formula. So what we did here is that we took the NASA Horizon Euphemery system data, which has orbits of 31 planetary bodies for 30 years. This is led by Pablo. And you have moons and planets, not just the planets here. And so we call what we did, you know, we did this with graph network, we model it, and then we try to extract the equation. So nearly exactly the same, because this time we simply use real data, right? Simply in this case is, you know, we don't know the masses, we only have the orbits. We only have 30 years of data, so you can't, you know, run simulations forever. So what happened when we used actual orbits from 30 years of observations? Great, we found the symbolic regression, we found Newton's law, that's okay. We also learned scalar quantities. I was kind of a little bit unsatisfied that we didn't find something like beyond Newton's law, but we can talk more about this later too. So we were able to do that. And let me just show you a couple of things. The inner solar system on the left here is the data from the bodies of the inner solar system. And on the right, in the same bodies evolve from the same initial condition, which is basically start of the data taking using the learned interaction. And you can see that they basically similar to each other. And here, this is the plot showing a couple of things that happen. The one on top is that we use the graph network plus symbolic regression that I described earlier. And you can see that if you plot the masses as a function of different planetary bodies, they're not all fitting very well. There are multiple dots here, multiple projections, because you can start from different sort of initialization of the network. And you can see that, well, the fit doesn't look so good. Like, you know, there's some things we should definitely improve. We plotted the gravitational influence and the error bar in the masses. And you can see that basically the lighter the stuff, the bigger the error bar is. It's not too surprising. But then what we did something, which is something a little bit next step that made the network do much better, is that we took the symbolic regression. It gave you a formula for the edge, right? Basically Newton's law. We plug it back into the network, into the edge function. Instead of a multi-layer perceptron, for those who do machine learning, instead of that, you actually plug in the actual formula that you learn with symbolic regression, and you do a relearn. You just relearn the masses, just make the prediction for the masses, and you can see that the truth and the prediction actually line up much better since. However, you know, the lighter moons, the gravitational influence, that basically, if the moon or the body's light come to, you know, the surrounding stuff that it actually has an influence on is really light, you will see that it has a much larger error bar, like Phoebe, Hyperion. While, you know, the heavier stuff, the better. We do not have such a good result as, you know, as I hope for Mercury, for example. Like Mercury has actually slightly larger error than I expected, but that's not too surprising when you look back, because, you know, we do not fit Mercury perfectly, but the amount that the Mercury doesn't fit perfectly isn't strong enough to push it for a different equation, basically. So this is something we're still working on, trying to figure out what to do, because what we decide is that there's a complexity and error bar. So that complexity, as it increases, your error of your prediction drops, right? But at some point you drop off a cliff, and we took the cliff and say, okay, once you have a huge drop in error, we take the simplest equation available. But I think there is a generic problem where, you know, you know, in this case, you know that the Mercury has this extra, it's very little differences. It's tiny, tiny differences due to GR. It actually has more influence coming from, like, you know, Jupiter and other stuff doing funny stuff. And that is not captured, and we know it's there. But that extra uncertainty or like discrepancy isn't big enough compared to all the other stuff fitting super well. So I don't think this is a specific example of what graph network or simple regression is not doing well, just even likelihood function usually, right? If you have one extra thing that doesn't, that's different, it's hard to kick it out of sort of the minimum. So we have the same issue here. We're still working on it, but for now we recover just Newton's law and all the masses quite well. So we're like, okay, we're submitting the paper. Here's a movie to end the talk, and we can have more questions later, to show how well these three different ways to do it, right? So the first one I'm going to show you is graph network, which is just using neural network to predict things. The, you know, mesh one is the truth, the solid one is the prediction. So give you, there's a difference between the prediction and the truth. And then the next one is when you take the graph network, you interpret it, do symbolic regression, find the formula, and use that formula to rotate, you know, to start from the initial conditions and show the difference. And then the last one is when you take that formula, plug it back to neural network, and let it basically evolve forward. So I'm gonna show you the movie. So the true is the mesh one, and projected in graph network, symbolic regression plus we learned masses. This is the last one that we show you in terms of much better result. Don't worry, we'll see each one of them separately, but just to give you a sense what is going on. All right. So the graph network one, you'll see actually there's a significant error. This is showing basically, you know, actual data sets, which is pretty cool. And you know, our prediction is not perfect with the neural network alone. And you see it pretty early, even with Earth. Sun is in the middle. I hope people recognize the planet. I had trouble finding the right planetary images to put on this. And then the next one is when you, instead of just using neural network, you use symbolic regression, find the formula, and also use that to find the fitted masses and everything and predict the orbit. You still see the error actually showing up already. Even for Earth, it's not perfect, but you also notice that, you know, Newton's law is not perfect. And the last one is what I showed you in the end, where we took what we learned using symbolic regression, which is the formula that we trust, plug it back into the neural network and make that prediction next. And you can see that they actually maintain quite nicely over, this is over the test time. And I think that's it. So how is this related to cosmology at all? I know I'm a cosmologist. I'm going to set one slide about cosmology. We have many fitting formulae in cosmology. Can we improve upon them? That's the easiest thing. We have a bunch of different work that we have not had a chance to talk about today. Connections between dark matter halo to galaxy properties, Enno Delgado, Boreana Ashinska, and Lars Hernquist and Jay Wadaka, they did work with us. And actually they made sort of like extended HOD, I guess, to these galaxies. And then for cluster properties, Leanna Teal, who's a Princeton graduate student, Billy Chen, who's actually an intern with us, and Will Colton, who's a postdoc at Flatiron, we also use this method to have much better predictions of SC, you know, thermosynthetic slippage effect properties that will go from dark matter halo, predict these properties of the galaxy, the cluster, and then, you know, can you find a fitting formula for it? So this happens many, many times, and with H1 predictions. So I'm just saying that we can find lots of fitting formula and make it much better, because now you know, you can just look at the data. Quick conclusions. I think human intuitions about system help us create useful inductive biases in our architecture design, in this case, graph neural network. We can understand a bit the network if you're able to sparsify it so that the number of latent parameters interpret is somewhat small using symbolic regression. This doesn't work for all network. If you give it a million parameter network, we're not gonna be able to do it. I mean, you'll have to sparsify somehow. For the machine learning crowd here, there is a lot of work trying to prune network to make network much smaller, to be understandable. There's also a lot of work in like scattering transform mode or other things where you try to encode whatever you're doing first with something that you understand, and then you do something you don't understand, usually with like a simple neural network, and try to make the interpretation easier, because then you have very few things you don't know what they are. The formula recovered from the network can guide us, I think, in understanding both the network and the system we model. I think what's more intriguing here is even for physical laws that we don't know the answer to, we can observe the system and hopefully let ML sort of help us find an analytical expression that sort of guides you into the right direction. I'm not saying we'll necessarily find fundamental law, but I think this possibly applies to many situations where we don't know sort of fitting formula a priori. And that's it. I'll take questions from here. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Feel free to unmute or clap however you will. Charlie, first question.
Hi, thanks for the really interesting talk. I guess I was wondering, the way that I was understanding it is we're taking all of the nodes kind of as a given, that's our data set, and we're trying to figure out how they're related to each other by these edges. I guess I was wondering if this sort of symbolic regression could ever predict a node, so to speak, like just given the first seven planets, could you predict Neptune? That's like the classic example.
Great question. This is actually exactly, I mean, more or less exactly what we were trying to do at the beginning. The beginning of the project, of the last part where we used real data, was that we were trying to find planet 9 and see whether we can like discover an unknown planet. The data doesn't say it so far. We're still working on it. I think if there is, the effect is very small, we might be put an error bar on it. But you actually do learn nodes. You can have invisible nodes. You can have nodes that come out, like that appear and disappear. So it is totally possible in graph network. And there's a node function that you can also learn. In our case, we learn the edge function, and it's easier to show. It is the edge function we're learning because it is the interaction that we're learning and concentrating on. But that's a great question, Charlie.
Before I go to Eric, could I just ask, might there be any other student questions? Going once, going twice. Okay, Eric. Oh, I'm actually not sure. Aman, are you a student?
Yeah.
Go for it.
I'm sorry. I was trying to raise my hand, but anyways, I was just wondering, is there like there's a lot of things we do or we read about like overfitting and also, is there such a problem that you face with these graph networks?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely need to make sure you're not overfitting a network. And that's why, you know, the standard checks that you have to employ, you all have to do. So basically, a lot of times people do try to overfit the network first, and then you kind of go backwards, right? So that happens with graph network too. It's not too special.
Okay.
We're hoping that what we described today, in the far future, where people can turn, you know, much larger network into much smaller network, we can also do something similar with not just graph network. The reason graph network works so well here is it's much easier to think of the interaction, something you want to get at, and the interaction is something you can just pull out from the edge function. So that's just much more obvious what you're supposed to pull. If you give me like convolution neural net, you just have very deep ones, then kind of hard what know what to pull out of it, right?
Yeah. Thank you.
Eric, go for it.
All right. Thank you for the talk. And I apologize if I missed something that you already said. How do you extract the analytic equation from the neural network? I didn't understand whether you encode several possibilities or whether the network explores, in principle, an infinitude of possibilities there.
This is an excellent question. I think there's why I probably didn't go into much details. It's about symbol regression. It's not something we invented. People have been doing it for a long time, where they encode equations in tree format. And then say, for example, if you have like cosine x plus sine y, you know, basically it's a tree. And what symbol regression does, and a lot of genetic algorithm does, is that you switch out the node if it doesn't fit the data very well. And depending on what method you use, there are many, many algorithms, you will decide how to switch it. Like it's an equal probability to all the other possible parameters. So it's a very large search tree. Just think of it as a search. And depending on what you choose, there are many different ways to search it. So we do make we actually had to write our own symbolic regression package because the previous one is it's like only commercially available. So we wrote our own and made it public. So if you're interested, we actually can show you actually very easily what that symbolic regression package is. It's actually quite fun to play. And you have like Python notebook they can play with right away.
Okay. Can you give me a pointer, the name of the package?
I'm immediately doing it, actually. Hold on a sec. It is a public package called Pycer. I'm sending you the GitHub, but if you want to have more information with the blog, I can also send you the blog page too. So Miles Crane is a student who wrote all this stuff, which is good.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's a great question.
Go for it, Rob.
Oh, thanks. Okay, well, that was a great talk. Thanks very much. You might have answered this question in your presentation and I missed it, but where is it that you sort of get the breaking of the degeneracy between, say, like a Hamiltonian and a Newtonian formulation of particle mechanics? So, you know, I can imagine that, you know, the planets could be characterized, you know, by the position and momentum, and then the dynamics is returned as first order Hamilton equations. Or it could be that, you know, all I have is the positions, and the dynamics that discovered sort of looks two time steps back at the positions to sort of infer the velocities. And so have you kind of set up the problem so that it necessarily gives you first order dynamics or not?
We didn't set up. So there are two answers to this. There's two layers, which I really appreciate your question. One is that for this particular work, we didn't set up anything special. We just let it learn. Like basically you have the positions and velocity, you learn what's happening. The network doesn't. The second thing we mentioned, which is really interesting, just saying, looking at Hamiltonian Lagrangian. So Miles had a separate paper, which I'm also author on, which is Lagrangian neural network, where you basically learn the Lagrangian or Hamiltonian, doesn't matter really. And then you use that learned quantity and then derive what happened next to the system. So then you're basically enforcing the idea, there's an idea of Lagrangian or Hamiltonian in this system, right? While in this work that I just showed today, we didn't enforce any of that. We didn't tell the network anything about Lagrangian, Hamiltonian, or even angular momentum or anything like that.
But that's useful, but I think maybe there's just one thing that you didn't quite get. What I'm suggesting is, like, if I understand correctly, you let it learn, you know, you give it a few different time steps to some extent. You know, here's what the positions and velocities were, say, at the first two time steps.
We only learn one time step at a time, but we give a lot of data. So that you see, like, the network will see one time step every time, like, so previous and current, and then, like, well, previous and current, basically. But then he'd see it many, many times. So, like, from different, so for the whole orbit, like, say orbits at 1,000 time steps, see 1,000
steps
for the network. So it's trained on one single time step. It's actually a choice that we make to do train single time step, not multi-time step. So when you do a multi-time step, you would probably could stabilize things a little bit more, because that means you know that for these four steps, it's going like this, and you have less error, like propagation, like in the future. We surprisingly didn't find help a lot. So we actually had choices made to, like, how many times have you training? Is it one, or is it like roll it 30 time steps?
Right. Mm-hmm. I guess in principle, if you expand it to say three time steps, you could drop all the velocities. You could say, I'm just going to look at the positions over multiple time steps. And then you should still be able to learn the dynamics based on that.
I think so. I mean, I think the problem was quote easy enough, like the planet one, because it's not like the balls bouncing four walls. I think that one will be much harder. But like the planets one was easy enough. We didn't really explore all the possibilities. We do have much harder time with the turbulence data sets to make predictions, like the 3D turbulence data sets. And that one, we actually explore these like multi-time steps and making it like a lot less crazy. I didn't have time to show you how well we end up doing, but it took a whole lot more work for the turbulence data sets.
Great. I have more questions, but I'll let others. Thanks very much.
Oh, that's great. Neil, you had no questions. Now I feel really bad. I'm just joking. So
if
I know.
You want, if you want, Shirley, I mean, I can add something. I was just curious, you know, I was curious if there's been any work on trying to combine this, you know, this framework, like more traditional, say, like EFT descriptions of, you know, of like structure formation, right? You know, so for example, right, you know, people have done like, you know, lots of work on trying to write down all possible terms that can appear, right? You know, and so maybe you could, you know, try something like that, where you enumerate all possible terms and then, you know, and then like use this, you know, on this symbolic regression to learn the coefficients, you know, as opposed to trying to compute them via these like horrible loop integrals. You know, is that practical? Or is the problem just that, you know, that the training set would be like impossibly large?
I think that will work. Actually, I think it's a really good idea that probably will work. I haven't done it myself, obviously. We're currently applying it to cancer data, which is very different. Like we're looking at cancer predictions using this network. In terms of survivability rates, actually. So kind of insane ideas, but there's really little rules there. They're like no fitting formula in medical sciences. So yeah, I think this is way much more reasonable thing to try.
Okay, thanks.
Great suggestion.
Lee, were you about to ask something or no?
No, it's very, very interesting. I'm very perplexed. So I've been working with a different kind of computer discovering or constructing laws. And I'm very puzzled by the results of the whole thing.
Can I ask, Shirley, do you think there's any prospect, or what do you think is the prospect for some sort of meta next layer of discovery by a neural network? I mean, so for example, a thing that comes to mind when finding equations is that, you know, there's this, obviously nowadays physicists often use this connection between symmetries and conserved quantities. And so if you see if you see a certain quantity that's conserved, you end up choosing the equations to reproduce that. Is there a way to somehow have that?
Yeah, we have that
insight.
Yeah, we are looking into how to impose symmetry within PySer, like the symbolic regression search, versus imposing in the neural network. So right now we sort of imposing some kind of symmetry within the neural network. So in the graph network, you're kind of imposing, so the fact that there is a graph structure. So there is an inductive bias there. And we use convolutional neural net imposing translational symmetry, but that's usually not imposed on the symbolic regression search for the equation. So that's something we do look into. We are basically human power limited. So if people are interested, we should work together. This is like really like so open area to the point that you can tell that we have things working left and right and there's only so many people.
I think Eric was next and then Lee.
Okay, thank you. Can you find out where you need more data? Can you associate an accuracy with the individual prediction and then say, I want two more measurements here and improve the prediction?
Yeah, usually it's very ad hoc, right? So if you have this much data, you train it out, you test on it, and it doesn't do well, you try to go by either improving the model or get more data. So it's not really a pretty formula that I can give you how to do this, I think. Sometimes people do data augmentation. Say, if you give me a data set, I will try to augment it by, say, rotating the box or something like this. But it's really not, science in some ways. Like, how do you know your network's not doing well? You should look at the loss function and say, okay, you want really good accuracy to 0.1%. You're not getting there. So either you change the network or you change the data.
I was thinking about the network making suggestions for where more physical experiments should be needed. So where the data are not good enough so that the model is inaccurate. So if you had better data, you could nail down the model. You could remove some inaccuracy there. So that's how a physicist thinks. That's when people design new observations or experiments.
I see what you mean. This is somewhat similar to people call reinforcement learning, where actually, Miles had a paper on this related topic where you have made some observations and you're trying to use the network to do something, to make, say, regression of like omega matter, how much dark matter there is in the universe. And then you realize, oh, you need to go take some more data to actually, for this type of galaxies, in order to get better constraint on omega matter. So there is a loop somewhere that you have to do an inference about something that you care about. I guess there's a reward function somewhere. And then you go back and say, you need to do X, and X here might be a better observation of this type of galaxy. So people are looking into this in terms of reinforcement learning. And I think the LSST people, I should say the Ferro-Rubin Observatory people, are thinking about it this way, to learn about new things that they have to follow up right away, but they can't follow up everything. So they need to choose what to follow up. So that's somewhat similar flavor to what you suggested. It's a great idea.
Lee.
Thank you.
We're being ambitious in a different direction. So this is work with Jaron Lanier and his colleagues at Microsoft Research. And we have constructed a three-way map from a certain landscape of gauge theories and gravitational theories to a neural network model, a particular kind of neural network model, to a matrix model to express the physics theory. And what we're interested in is whether, given that coupling, that is where in stating your neural network in terms of laws of physics that can change, and we're expressing that in terms of matrix models, which we can understand and compute with. And our hypothesis is that this is kind of mechanism, and people are going to laugh, but we mean it, could be a way in which the laws of nature themselves evolve. And in some sense, what we're interested in is the universe discovering what its laws would best be. We think that's much more interesting than whatever we could do to discover ourselves with the laws.
This is really interesting. We should chat offline because it seems like you are looking into things in a very different direction, but in similar flavor than what we're interested in.
I'd be very happy to. So,
yeah, sounds great.
Right.
Rob?
Okay, a question about what you described at the end regarding how if you allow the mass parameters and the dynamics to vary, you don't do as well as if you sort of first learn the dynamics and then fix the dynamics, learn the mass parameters. Is there kind of a lesson for sort of, you know, how one ought to design a better neural network where you could sort of just allow one to evolve with the other fixed and then swap and kind of converge in a sort of more natural way than to just do it brute force twice?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. So this is something what Miles and I've been thinking about, where you sort of like want to do pieces of this. Like if you learn simple regression with a piece that you know work already, you've put it in and then you sort of make another prediction, maybe you would make like a residual prediction. Like what's the difference between the true answer and well the true observable and what you're predicting? Like there is a difference and maybe you can actually make a prediction just for that residual. Like maybe there's an extra constant to the law that you need to add in. So this is something people like to use the word residual learning when you try to learn the residual or something, but I think it just names to it, but it's unclear. We haven't done much yet, but this is an interesting idea.
I guess what I was thinking is kind of trying to implement this in a more bootstrap way. So don't, you know, presume that, you know, okay, I've got the right dynamics now, let's find a better estimate of the masses, but rather sort of let it go back and forth. So, you know, if you'd continued, you might say, all right, well, now we have a better estimate of the masses, let's go back, fix the masses, let the dynamics change again, and keep kind of honing in on better versions of each in order to sort of get more precision.
This is interesting. We haven't done it. Maybe you should try. I mean, all the code's public. This could be kind of fun, actually. And it really goes in the same direction of, you know, it's an interplay between the symbolic regression and the network. So symbolic regression helps the network to make better predictions, and it comes back to it and say, okay, can you do better in this particular way now that I do better predictions? So it could be really interesting. We should talk.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.
Sebastian, maybe last question.
Okay, very, very, very quick comment. So about Lee's question. So when you want to do gauge symmetries and neural networks, it's very hard to train a neural network to learn these gauge symmetries. And what you're basically suggesting is, from the other side, it's there are works that build in fixed gauge symmetries in some networks. So but you're suggesting something that is in between, some emergent gauge symmetry with neural networks, but which is not fixed, right? So that works, but the capacity of neural networks is, or the training of neural networks is normally quite hard, so that this only works in very small lattices.
No, we don't have that problem, but we code the gauge theories in a way very different than you would expect. So with the normal way of coding gauge theories in neural networks wastes huge numbers of degrees of freedom, the same reason lattice gauge theory does, because almost everything is gauge. But we code them, I don't want to quite say symbolically, but in terms of a template, we don't have the neural network running the Monte Carlo simulation or something like that. We have the neural network symbolizing a representation of the gauge theory. And the language involves the matrix models.
Seems like you guys have a lot of machine learner cross string theory people here.
Machine learning, excuse me?
I just found a lot of my ex-string theory friends who turn into machine learning are sort of in that particular area. They're very interested in symmetry and how to put symmetry into the network or try to extract symmetries. You know, surprisingly, Jan LeCun is like one of those who really likes his energy-based models, and he was really interested in physics, I think. So, yeah.
Well, we have a much smaller landscape, but still landscape that includes the standard model, coupled to general relativity. So. But I'll send you our paper and I'd be glad to.
Yes, sounds great.
All right. Well, thank you again so much, Shirley, for talking to us. Let's give everyone one last hand.